whose government cannot allow to happen, though the media is almost guaranteed to portray it as such, is for the predictable Hezbollah and Hamas counterattacks against Israel to be somehow viewed by the world as equally legitimate, given Israel's attacks on a so-called innocent Iran. This is where we are, a coming fight for what will be a very angry world community when Netanyahu has to make this move. Where are we going to stand? Will America truly be a friend of Israel? I don't think so. Barack Obama has shown his colors already. He is a friend of the Muslim world. Thanks for joining us here on Viewpoint. I trust that you'll be praying for the peace of Jerusalem. Get a copy of the book Seduction of the Saints. And we trust that you will go before the Lord as we would have you to give to become a partner with us and send your gifts by faith to Save America Ministries, P.O. Box 70879, Richmond, Virginia 23255.
You've been listening to Viewpoint with Chuck Crismeyer. Viewpoint is supported by the faithful gift.
This is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, that illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. We are going to bring you, for the next hour, the views of Colonel Tom McKinney, a friend. I've never met him, but we certainly have been friends for many years. Lieutenant Colonel Tom McKinney fought in Korea. He fought in South Vietnam for many years and was involved with many of the things that went on over there, and eventually after he came back to America, began to understand that the wars, neither war, were fought to win. There was another agenda out there, and so he came back home and organized an independent ministry, trying to let people understand the spiritual nature of the affairs that are going on today. But for many years, he's been researching a story of a man named Jack Hinson, which most people have never heard of. But he's written a book called Jack Hinson's One Man War, A Civil War Sniper. And it's a fascinating book, and I've really enjoyed reading it. It gives you tremendous insight into the Civil War, the futility of this war is the futility of most wars. One man's effort to overcome his feeling of hurt and anger and fury, because he had two sons who were killed senselessly and decapitated and their heads put on the posts at the entrance to his farm. He wanted to be neutral. He didn't want to get involved in the war at all, but he was forced. Well, let's let Colonel McKinney tell the story. Good evening, Colonel. Thanks very much for being with us.
Good evening, Dr. Monteith. It's good to hear your voice again.
Well, I'm going to let you tell the story of Jack Hinson, and I want to get your impression of it, because I view what he did as, with mixed emotions, let's put it that way, and I want to know what you think about what he did and his response to an obvious injustice.
Yes, well, it's the story of one remarkable man and his family, and it's a story of a man who didn't want secession, didn't want the war. He was a prosperous plantation owner and a businessman, engaged in many things on the Kentucky-Tennessee border. And as I said, he didn't want secession, didn't want the war, but the war came to him. And a major battle was fought there, the battle at Fort Donelson, and part of it on his land. And after the battle, the war moved on to the east, and incidentally, it was an extremely pivotal battle, in my opinion, and I make the case for it in this book. The war was lost for the South on that Sunday morning when the unnecessary surrender was made at Fort Donelson, but of course that's a uh, very secondary issue in the story. But the war moved on to the east, and the occupation troops came in behind it, and they murdered two of his sons, and as you just said, cut their heads off, put their heads on the old man's gateposts, and made an instant enemy of him. Now, there are erroneous opinions. Since the book was published, there a lot of people have become interested in the story, and there are some contrary opinions by amateurs to the effect that he was a captain in the Confederate Army and that he led a dashing command of cavalry, and none of which is true. He never wore a uniform of any kind. He was just one angry man seeking vengeance.
Well, you hold that thought. We're going to be back here in just a moment with Colonel Tom McKinney and his story of Jack Hinson's One Man More. Pick the story up there, Colonel.
Okay. And he set out to get vengeance. The law of vengeance was in his genes from the Scottish Highlands of his ancestors. And he had a special rifle made for long-range accuracy. It's 50 caliber. It weighs 18 pounds, and it can't be held steady at offhand. It has to be fired from a rest. But it gave him what he wanted, and he got most of his kills between 600 and 800 yards, and some of them beyond 1,000. He set out quietly to get vengeance, and at first he only wanted to kill the lieutenant who had ordered the death of his sons and cut their heads off with his saber. Then he killed the sergeant who had put his son's heads on his gateposts and taken such pleasure in causing such emotional agony for his wife and children and the servants who grieved. But after he killed the sergeant, he realized that it wasn't going to stop there, that it was only a matter of time until the Union occupiers discovered that he had done this. He was the most likely suspect. And on one horribly cold winter night in a snowstorm, the Union troops came out and burned his house to the ground and drove his family off into the blizzard. And his wife and children were packed up in a crude sled covered with hay and were taken across the Tennessee River into the adjacent county, where they found refuge with relatives and stayed there for the rest of the war. Two of the small children had measles, and they died on that trip across the river to Henry County. And he went the opposite direction into the woods and began his campaign as a lone sniper. And the short version of the story is that by the end of the war, he had killed well over 100. He only claimed 36 because he only counted as confirmed kills the ones where he could actually approach the body and make certain. For example, when he was firing into a boat loaded with armed soldiers and they were firing back at him, he could see the men go down, but he didn't know whether they were dead or would survive their wounds, and so he didn't count them. He counted only 36, and he kept a careful record of those on...
Hold that thought.
Yeah.
Well, this is Dr. Stan, and Colonel McKinney is simply telling the story of Jack Hinson, who set out to avenge the death of his two sons. Originally, it was to kill the lieutenant who had killed his sons and cut off their heads. And then, of course, he killed the sergeant who had put the heads on spikes in the front of his house. But then he continued this because, of course, he realized that they would come after him. There was no ending this as long as the war was on. And so he lived in the hills there in Kentucky systematic. Was it Tennessee or Kentucky?
It was just over the border in Tennessee.
All right.
But part of his, how can I say it, his territory covered both sides of the border.
But, of course, he became really one of the most wanted men. And how many men did they put out trying to track him down? I mean,
this is one of the most remarkable things about it. It's also instructive of the efficiency of that kind of guerrilla warfare, the effect that one man can have and how difficult it is, how many of the enemy's troops can be tied up trying to find one man. But by the end of the war, the Union had committed against this one old man, and incidentally he was an old man by the standards of the day, elements of 9 regiments, both infantry and cavalry, and an amphibious task force of Marines and sailors mounted, and they never got him. That amphibious task force itself was a fascinating thing. Some of your listeners, Dr. Stan, will have seen the movie Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid. And the point of that is that in the movie, and I think in reality, the Pinkertons had built a special boxcar for the railroads, for the trains, and it had a ramp that could be run out immediately, and they had their posse, or whatever you would call them, the lawmen, mounted already inside the boxcar so that if a train was attacked, they could open the sides, doors, and run out the ramp, and they would come galloping out and chase the bad guys. And this is the way it was done. This amphibious task force had specially made shallow draft boats for high speed, and they could actually run them up on the banks of the river and run out a ramp, and they had Marines already mounted in the boat who could gallop down the ramp and go off after the sniper or the guerrillas, whatever they were. They were singularly unsuccessful. It was not a bright page in Marine Corps history. But this is an example of the enormous combat power that can be tied up chasing one man or a small number of guerrillas this way, when the guerrillas are working in their own backyard, so to speak, and the attackers are not. And this man, this one old man, and he was old by the standards of the day. He was born in 1807, and in 63 he was 56, and he was 59 at the end of the war. And at any rate, the rigors of living in the wilderness in all kinds of weather, as well as being on the go all the time to keep away from his pursuers, aged him considerably. But they never got the old man, and he lived 9 years after the war and died of natural causes. But every day of those 9 years, he lived under the hanging sword of Damocles in the form of the threat of being any day marched before a military tribunal under Reconstruction and hanged. And if it weren't for the fact that he had been a wealthy and influential man before the war, and he had still friends, judges and lawyers and politicians with influence, he probably wouldn't have lasted very long after the war. In fact, he was under indictment when he died.
Well, was he under indictment then as a traitor to the Union, or what was it?
Oh, yes. Yes.
Now, basically, how did he manage to live, you know, by himself there in the woods? What did he eat? Where did he get his supplies?
Well, the best way he could. He had friends, of course, all over that area. And it could not be blanketed with occupation troops. They went out on patrols and generally followed predetermined patrol routes. And there were vast areas of the wilderness where he would perhaps be the only person there, except for scattered farms, and a lot of those scattered farms were the homes of people who knew him and cared for him and helped to take care of him. By and large, he tried to stay away from them because he didn't want to draw them into his problems and get them in trouble. But They did supply him with some of the things that he couldn't possibly get from the wilderness, but he also killed game and really managed rather well. And from time to time, he would go back clandestinely to his plantation, even though the house was gone. His servants were still there, and they would resupply him with coffee and beans and things that he couldn't get out of the wilderness. He really did fairly well. A great deal of the time, he made his home in a cave. And I spent some time in that cave. And it was ideal for the purpose to which he put it.
Well, now, of course, he basically would target officers, you know, there was a ship, and of course, a lot of it was ships that were going up and down the rivers there. Was that primarily the groups that he went after, or did he go after the patrols? What did he go after primarily?
He did both, Dr. Stan. His favorite firing point, though, was on a bluff called Graffin Reed Bluff. This is where his cave was, up at the top of the bluff, and there was a rock ledge there near the cave from which he could see down onto the Tennessee River. And at that point, there was a small island just offshore called the Towhead. And at that point, for reasons unknown to me, I guess just the way God designed it, the channel of the Tennessee River ran between that little island and the bank through a very narrow neck called the Towhead Chute, and it was called a chute because the force of the river was concentrated and forced through that narrow, whatever you would call it, space, and therefore the current was extremely fast, and boats going downstream went through it at breathtaking speed, and boats going upstream were barely able to make progress against the current. And so the boats going from north to south had to go against the current, because this is a fascinating geographical setting too. It's an area today called Land Between the Lakes National Recreation Area. In those days, there were no lakes, no dams. It was the Tennessee River on the west, Cumberland River on the east. And at this point, the Tennessee and the Cumberland, in their last run, turn north and flow from south to north for about 60 miles, more or less parallel, into the Ohio River, which is a mile wide at their mouths. And so what it was an inland peninsula, and there were no bridges. And so the people who lived in there were relatively isolated. And because the rivers run from south to north, the people called north down, because it was downstream, and south up. And their descendants in the area still do today. They talk about going down to Paducah when it's really north, or up to Clarksville when it's really south. At any rate, it was his favorite place was on the Tennessee River, on this bluff high above the Tennessee River. And because the supply boats and the reinforcement transports loaded with troops went primarily from north to south, pursuing the war, they had to go up the Towhead Chute against the current, and they moved so slowly, it made them almost stationary targets. And he quickly found that this was going to be a very advantageous place for him, and it did become his favorite spot. And as you pointed out, his targets of choice were officers, because it was a lieutenant who had ordered the execution of his sons and then beheaded them. And it was a colonel who had established the policy that they could be executed on suspicion without a trial. And it was the policy of General Rosecrans, who was the Union commanding general of the Department of the Missouri, who established this policy, that even if someone was suspected of guerrilla activity, that was justifiable grounds for execution on the spot. And often their families could be executed on the assumption that they knew what the guy was doing but didn't report him. And in some cases, even their neighbors were executed without a trial.
Well, there was a tremendous amount of cruelty, you know, on the part of the Union soldiers and the Union forces. Certainly we know that when General Lee took the Confederate troops up into Pennsylvania and into the north, why, he wouldn't attack the towns, he wouldn't attack civilians, and yet the Union forces were really ruthless in the treatment of civilians and anybody that they suspected of opposition. Would that be a fair assessment? But General Sherman had said, you know, war is hell. You know, and there's no way to simplify it, and it really is. I mean, you've got to totally destroy the will of the opponent to win, and this is why you don't really want to get into wars, because it not only can destroy the enemy, it can destroy you as well.
Oh, yes.
We'll be back in just a moment here with Colonel Tom McKinney. Well, what made you spend, 15 years researching this story?
That's right. Yeah, about 1965.
Gold and silver is tremendously undervalued. Global demand vastly exceeds mine supply by more than 60% annually. There is little in the financial world more certain than a coming explosion in the prices of gold and silver. The U.S. dollar continues to lose value and respect as the world's reserve currency. Our nation faces challenges on many fronts, and a day doesn't pass without another economist bringing forth warnings of impending economic calamity. There has never been a better time than right now to acquire physical gold and silver. Discount Gold and Silver Trading was founded on the principles of truth and honesty. We believe in providing a quality product, quality service, and most importantly, competitive pricing. We provide all forms of precious metals, including American gold, silver, platinum, and rare investment and circulated coins. Silver bars, rounds, and 90% silver bags are on hand for the silver investor. Gold self-directed IRAs are available. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. Toll free, that's 1-800-375-4188.
Most Americans are iodine deficient today because they stopped adding iodine to our milk and to our flour, and only about half of the salt that's consumed in the United States today contains iodine. So Radio Liberty has produced a 4-tape or a 4-CD set that discusses the health benefits of iodine. We also offer iodorol. It contains 12.5 milligrams of iodine per tablet. And we also offer potassium iodide tablets that'll protect your thyroid gland in case there's a nuclear attack. So if you'd like to order these products or obtain additional information, why don't you call 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. Or go to our website at radioliberty.com. That's radioliberty.com. Once again, our telephone number, 1-800-544-8927.
Did you know that there's an increasing amount of scientific data which says that fluoride in drinking water is dangerous? Are you aware that your drinking water may in fact contain many unhealthy substances, even things which can cause sickness or disease? If you'd like information on how to remove these contaminants, find out about the Verkey water filter. You can call 800-544-8927 for complete information. There is a way to return to having pure, safe drinking water. The Verkey water filter. Call 800-544-8927 for information about a product that could protect you and your family from waterborne disease. The number to call is 800-544-8927. Call today.
This is Pastor David Whitney with Institute on the Constitution. Our founders constructed this constitutional republic with the intent that citizens would function as the final check on the power of civil government. But that design would only work if the citizens understood our form of government as well as their responsibilities within that structure. That's why Institute on the Constitution has put together a host kit that enables anyone, anywhere, with any group of people to instruct them on our founding documents. We urge you to order a host kit. You can call us us toll-free at 866-730-9796. That's 866-730-9796. Or you can order it on the web. Go to our website, iotconline.com. The only way our republic will survive is if its citizens arm themselves with the knowledge of our founding fathers' original intent of the Constitution, the Declaration, and the Bill of Rights. Call us, 866-730-9796.
Tracking down the story of Jack Hinson. And he'd actually seen a historical marker there. It's in a place called Golden Pond. Just mentioned this sniper who had killed 15 men during the Civil War as a lone sniper. And that's about all it said. You know, and of course, he'd done this in reprisal for the murder and decapitation of his two sons. And so Colonel actually, 25 years later, had a mild stroke and took some time off, and he suddenly began just accumulating information. He found the rifle, and that started this effort to put the whole incredible story together. And, well, I'm going to let you pick up the story there.
Yes, I've forgotten where we were, Dr. Stan.
Well, you'd found the rifle, you'd had the chain of possession to the rifle.
Yeah.
And so then you obviously must have set out to track down all the records and the letters and the information that was available.
I had accomplished very little except that I did find the rifle. And my month ended, and I had to go back to doing what I did, and 3 years later, I had another slight stroke, and again, gave myself a month off to recover. This time, I went in search of the family, and I discovered, during the course of this research, I discovered several things, and one of them is the great value of these obscure little county historical societies and these little county libraries. I began to go from library to library and historical society to historical society. These people in these county historical societies will not be educated. They will not be trained historians or researchers. They just are people who care about their history and have a zeal for digging it out and sorting things out. And they will go through these old deed books and organize the records. They'll go to the basement of the courthouse and go through these dirty, dusty records and systematize them. And they publish their findings in these little fold and staple booklets that they have made at Kinko's or Office Depot. And they go on the shelf in the county library, and hardly anyone ever sees them. I discovered that there are treasures untold in these little county libraries. And so I went from one to another. I put ads in the newspapers. I had an 800 number. If you know anything about this man or his story, please contact me. And I got a few responses that were helpful, but not much. Where I really began to find helpful information was largely in those little county libraries. And I went from one to the other, and I would photocopy anything they had that had the word Hinson in it. And I was at the last one. I made a circle around the entire area where the story takes place, and I was at the last one in Aaron, Tennessee. I'd been there for a week, and I was leaving, I was finished, and I was tired and frustrated and disappointed, and I started out the door, and the historian, God bless her, Kay French is her name, she stopped me. And she said, you know, you really should contact Francis Hinson. And I was so tired that I didn't even, you know, the name didn't even ring a bell. And I said, why? And she must have thought, I'm dealing with the dumbest man in the world. But she said, well, she was gracious, of course, and didn't say that, but I'm sure she thought it. She said, well, she's very active in the historical society here in the county, and she might be able to help you. And I didn't want to call her. I still hadn't made the connection with the name Hinson. So she handed me the telephone and told me the number, and somewhat reluctantly, I dialed the number. And a grumpy man answered the phone. He said, "Hello." And I told him who I was and asked him if I could speak with Francis Hinson, please. And he said, "No." I had encountered my first Hinson man, and they aren't always gracious. And I didn't know what to say. I had never had that I'd never before asked to speak with someone and just been told no. So I told him again who I was and what I was trying to do, and I said, "I'm trying to find this man's descendants. I have not been able to find the Hinson family." And there was a slight pause, and he said, "I'm his great-grandson." And I either dropped the telephone or almost dropped the telephone. And so I asked him if I could come out, and he said no. I asked him if I could come out the next day. He said his wife was tired. She'd been on a trip. And he said yes, and so I did, and that's how I met Francis. That's how I met Charles Dudley Hinson, the great-grandson of Jack Hinson. And at that time...
Hold that thought. We'll be back in just a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan here, and of course that's certainly our theme song, and I don't know whether God would ever bless America again, certainly considering the things that have gone on, but we can hope and pray for it. But the song brings back memories of bygone days when America was a God-fearing country, when, of course, a man's word was as good as his bond, and we'll be back in just a moment with Colonel Tom McKinney. Well, this is Dr. Stan, I guess, Lieutenant Colonel Tom McKinney, retired from the Marine Corps. We're talking about his book, Jack Hinson's One Man War, where Jack Hinson took on the entire Union Army, and they used as much as fragments of parts of six regiments to try to track him down, and they were never able to apprehend him. Well, Colonel, before we go on, would you like to get your website out or tell people how they could get hold of the book and they'd be interested in it?
Well, the book is available in almost any bookstore. Borders, Books a Million, Barnes & Noble, carry it. Sam's and Walmart carry the book. I always try to urge people to go, if they have a locally owned bookstore, to go there, because it's so difficult for these little independent bookstores to compete with the giant chains. But it is available, Amazon.com, and they can even buy it from the publisher at Pelican Pub, all run together, Pelican P-U-B. .com. They can go to their website and order the book there at a discount.
All right, fine. Well, of course, now you were just telling us how you met Jack Henson, what was his great-grandson or great-great-grandson?
Great-grandson. And at the time that I finally connected with the family, there were four great-grandchildren living, two great-grandsons and two great-granddaughters. Today, both great-grandsons have died. The two great-grandsons were both very, very eager to help once they began to trust me. As I say, people in that area are very suspicious of outsiders even today. And but once they got to know me, they became extremely helpful. One of the great-granddaughters was helpful at times and wouldn't even return a phone call or answer a letter at times. She's a little peculiar in that way. And the other great-granddaughter I've never even met, even though she lived right there in the county. She just was completely disinterested. But they helped a great deal. And but Frances Henson, Charles Dudley's wife, the one he wouldn't let me talk to the first time I called, she became my right arm. And in the acknowledgments in the book, I begin by saying that the book couldn't have been written without her, and that's a fact. And it's been so fulfilling for her and the others in the family who cared. And in fact, the entire region is so grateful that that book has been published. It's been amazing to me. I think I could run for office in any one of those counties and win. It's been satisfying, to say the least, in that way. And they've come to these book signings and just thanked me and said, you've put our county on the map. You've told a story that's never been told, and so forth. They're very, very good to me and nice to me. But back to the project, from that time on, Frances had been gathering what information she could about Jack Henson for several years. And of course, she gave me everything she had. And between the two of us, we finally put the pieces together. It took a lot of travel. I have been in every county library, every county archive, the state archives in Tennessee and Kentucky, the national archives, the rare books and papers collection at Duke University, the rare books and papers collection at the University of North Carolina, Austin Peay, Murray, every school that promised even to have anything that would be useful. And we finally found enough of the pieces to put the story together and make it coherent and make it valid. I was interviewed, Dr. Stan, by the Washington Times, and incidentally, they've been really good to me about the book. And the first question he asked me was, what were your primary sources? And I said, there aren't any. It was like working a jigsaw puzzle with the pieces scattered from Missouri to the East Coast and a lot of them missing. And it took a long, long time to find enough of those pieces and to be able to put them together and come up with a story. But we have done it. One of the reasons it was so difficult, in fact, the primary reason it was so difficult, I think, is that in the third generation, that is the generation of old Jack Henson's grandchildren, This family was a rather prominent family locally, and it was decided that the old man was an embarrassment to the family, and after all, he had been a hunted man, a fugitive with rewards on his head, and killed all those people, and it was decided not to allow the children to hear any of the stories. And silence settled over the story of Jack Henson at that time. The last one who knew a lot of the details died in 1965. In fact, she was the one responsible for the fact that that no one else did. And that made it extremely difficult. Another question he asked me was, what did I learn in the process? And I'm glad he did, because the answer to that is extremely important. I learned a lot. And one of the most important things I learned in the process of scratching out this story is how the people, the innocent civilians, suffered in the back country after the war passed on. It was bad enough as the war passed over them, especially in Georgia, South Carolina, and North Carolina at the hands of Sherman. But in all parts of the war, once the real battlefront moved on and the occupation troops came in, the people were victimized by the occupation troops. They were victimized by people who called themselves guerrillas but were really just self-serving criminals. And they literally suffered horribly. And for the most part, they were helpless. Women and children on isolated farms, the men were gone to war or dead. And sometimes the occupation troops would moonlight, and when they were off duty, just go out and rob, rape, pillage, and murder. And the same thing, of course, was done by guys that called themselves guerrillas and some who didn't even pretend but just were thugs and criminals. And the suffering was great, and the cruelty was horrible. And an example that I cite in the book was an old man named James Gray, who lived in Stewart County, right in the heart of the area where Jack Henson operated. And he was a hero of the War of 1812. He was co-author of the Tennessee Constitution and a Baptist minister. And he was very old and poor. And some of these thugs came to his farm one night and demanded to know where he had buried the money, and he told them he didn't have any, which was the truth. And they built a fire, strapped him to a plank, and literally roasted his feet until finally they realized that he didn't have any, and they rode off and left him in agony. And he survived, but he was terribly crippled from that day on for the rest of his life. And at times, Dr. Stan, it was worse than that. There was even one legitimate Union regiment in Tennessee, in that part of Tennessee, the 6th Tennessee Union Cavalry. And the commander was a particularly cruel and brutal man. And they captured a Confederate lieutenant who was home on leave to see his sick father, and they tortured him to death, literally skinned his face, did horrible things that we don't even like to think about to him before he died. And the cruelty seemed to know no bounds. I think there's no limit to man's capacity for brutality and cruelty. I learned the suffering was horrible, and the people were also victimized in having their food taken away and their livestock taken away.
Well, what is your impression of Henson? I mean, here is a man who was justifiably furious, angry. He and his family had been certainly brutalized, But what about his response? Was this a
Well, one of the lessons in this book, Dr. Stan, is the price of vengeance. It always carries a high price. The war cost him 7 of his 10 children. It cost him his plantation home, burned to the ground, and it cost him all of his businesses and real estate enterprises that he was involved in before the war. It cost him his life as he had known it. And that's one of the lessons in the book. But the guy was amazing. He was amazing. In the first place, he freed all of his slaves before the Emancipation Proclamation. Because after the occupation troops moved in, he saw what was happening to his neighbors. They were having their slaves, confiscated. And they were called contraband. They weren't even treated like human beings. They were treated like work animals. And they were put into these forced labor gangs and never seen again. And the responsible slave owners, except for those of the very lowest type, cared about their slaves and didn't call them slaves. They called them servants and considered them part of the family. And he didn't want his slaves, his servants, to be taken away by men who didn't care anything about them and out of his control to protect and care for them. And he decided that they would be safer if they were legally what were called free men of color or free persons of color. And so he had this all done legally and officially and freed them all, and they all stayed with him. He certainly wasn't privy to what Lincoln was going to do. He was just a kind of a prescient man, a very astute businessman. And I think also he must have converted his Confederate currency to gold early in the war, realizing that eventually this was going to turn out the other way. Because after he came in out of the woods, he stayed in the forest after the war for quite a while, but he came back and his family came back across the river from the from their relatives in Henry County. He bought another farm, which he called Magnolia Hill. It had a grist mill, a sawmill, a blacksmith shop, and a country store, and paid cash for it in gold. He was one of these guys you just couldn't keep down, and he lived out the last 9 years of his life operating his farm, his country store, and watching his grandchildren grow and died, and lived in relative peace, and died of natural causes.
Well, I think that vengeance has a terrible price to pay. And you sort of wonder, you know, just down the line, if he ever stopped and contemplated that. Certainly, he had every reason to be furious. He had every reason to want to strike out against the Union troops and the brutality. But in the long run, was it worth it to him? What do you think?
Yeah, of course not. But you see, Dr. Stan, almost all of the people between the rivers, in isolation, independent, self-reliant, were descended from Scottish immigrants who were driven out of Scotland in what were called the clearings when the English aristocrats wanted their land for hunting preserves and whatnot, and they literally just drove them out. And they most of them came to the Carolinas and then moved westward into Tennessee and Kentucky. And, excuse me. A common sociological phenomenon among those people was the law of vengeance. And they brought it with them. And it was to them, I'm sure, it was the normal thing to do, that it would have been wrong not to take vengeance in that way. But as you say, and as I hope I make clear in the book, it comes at a very high price.
I mean, you can't help but really respect him. I mean, his accomplishments really as one man against a whole army are just almost incredible. Did you ever find the lieutenant who had actually killed his sons?
Well, the general belief is that he was the first kill.
Okay.
Nobody but God really knows. But you mentioned that his accomplishments were amazing, and they really were. He made history, literally made military history on two occasions. On one occasion, he was firing into a loaded troop transport, and it was a gunboat loaded with infantry troops, and they were armed. And it was in the towhead chute, struggling to make steerage way. And he killed so many of them on that boat that the Navy captain of the boat, dropped anchor and ran up the white flag and surrendered to that one old man. It's the only time in history that a naval fighting vessel, a gunboat, loaded with embarked infantry troops who were also armed, surrendered to one man. And, of course, Jack Henson was just as amazed as the captain was discouraged, I guess, and the captain expected at any moment to have cavalry come galloping down the riverbank and take possession of his boat and make prisoners of the troops, but nobody came because there was nobody there but this one old man. And so finally the skipper got wise and ran down the white flag and ran up his own flag and steamed away. But it's the only time in history that it's ever known to have happened. He also made history in early November of 1864 when he led Nathan Bedford Forrest and his entire command, including artillery, 30 miles up the west bank of the Tennessee River without being noticed by the Union troops across the river. And they set up opposite the Johnsonville Supply Depot, which was the supply depot that on which Sherman depended in his campaign through Georgia and the Carolinas. And
Hold that thought. We'll be back in just a moment with Colonel Tom McKinney. Go right ahead, Colonel.
Yes. The first clue that the Union defenders over at the depot...
Heart disease is on the rise. Clogged arteries, high blood pressure, and high cholesterol levels may not be fully detected by you, but the symptoms are there. Loss of energy, blood sugar spikes and drops, poor circulation, and irregular heartbeat are just a few of these that can alert you that something is wrong. Hear how Heart and Body Extract is making a difference in thousands of people's lives across America.
My blood pressure has normalized. My diabetes has totally improved.
Everyone is telling me now how much healthier I look, and I'm telling everyone how much healthier I feel. I recommend Heart and Body Extract to everyone.
Anybody over 40 in the North American continent should be using this product as a preventative to keep their cardiovascular system healthy.
Order your two-month supply today by calling 866-295-5305. That's 866-295-5305. Or order online, hbextract.com. Heart and Body Extract, 866-295-5305 or hbextract.com.
We know America is changing, but most of the changes that are taking place seem to be designed to take away our freedom. And what can you do to remedy the current situation? Well, you can become informed, and one of the best ways to become informed is to subscribe to Republic Magazine, because that magazine provides the information that's suppressed in most other news magazines. If you want to oppose the effort to establish a one-world government, if you want to preserve freedom here in the United States and throughout the world, I suggest you subscribe to Republic Magazine, and you can do that by calling 1-800-873-1620. That's 800-873-1620, or access their website at www.republicmagazine.com. That's republicmagazine.com. I suggest you get extra copies for your family and your friends.
This is Pastor David Whitney with Institute on the Constitution. Our founders constructed this constitutional republic with the intent that citizens would function as the final check on the power of civil government. But that design would only work if the citizens understood our form of government as well as their responsibilities within that structure. That's why Institute on the Constitution has put together a host kit that enables anyone, anywhere, with any group of people to instruct them on our founding documents. We urge you to order a host kit. You can call us toll free at 866-730-9796. That's 866-730-9796. Or you can order it on the web. Go to our website, iotconline.com. The only way our republic will survive is if its citizens arm themselves with the knowledge of our founding fathers' original intent of the Constitution, the Declaration, and the Bill of Rights. Call us, 866-730-9796.
And he's certainly one of my favorite human beings and a very, very courageous man. We've really felt it a privilege to know him and work with him through the years. But his book, Jack Hinson's One Man War, how one man took on the whole Union Army, and six regiments or parts of them could never catch him. And he eventually, of course, survived the war and lived some 9 years after that. It's an amazing, amazing story about a very courageous man. But, you know, as you read it and you wonder, will vengeance, of course, soothe the feeling of anger and hostility that becomes when you have been mistreated? Well, it's well worthwhile reading, and it is available, and I think probably we'll be carrying it down the line. Under any circumstances, this is the time when I need to remind our listeners that Radio Liberty, my ministry, is primarily listener-supported, and if you're in a position to help, our number is 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. And then, of course, we want to remind you about our all-day seminar that's on the 25th of October, and it's going to be at the Aptos Seascape Golf Course. You need reservations, and tomorrow's the last day you can get the special on the hotel. They cut their special rates off as of the 24th. So if you're thinking about coming from out across America, why, you'll certainly want to get your hotel reservations in. And, of course, since we're serving lunch, why, we'll need to hear from you. Our number, 1-800-544-8927. Now, one of the things, of course, which everybody's talking about is the dreaded swine flu, which, incidentally, is such a mild disease that in the paper that was used to justify the disseminating of the vaccine, first of all, it was a bait and switch. They used tested one vaccine in Australia, but that's not the vaccine that's going to be released and used here in the United States. But basically, in that study, they tested the people for antibodies to the disease. They excluded everybody who had swine flu or any influenza or anything else, and then they tested them before they went ahead with the evaluation, 3 weeks, gave the vaccine, and then they checked at intervals during a three-week period to find out the antibody response. But they found out when they checked the study that 14% of one group and 39% of the other group that were in this study already had the disease, didn't even know that had it. What is happening across America is the epidemic is peaking out. California is already I certainly have passed its peak, as has Maine and a good deal of New England. But you're not going to hear this in the media because they've got 195 million doses of this vaccine. They're threatening people in New York, threatening healthcare workers to take away their pension if they don't take this needless vaccine. And it's one of the greatest frauds of all time. And they're going to poison our children with the mercury. They're trying to get children less than 10 to take 2 doses of regular vaccine and 2 doses of the swine flu vaccine to use it up and to poison them and destroy their minds. 1 in every 6 American children, according to the CDC's own figures, has a learning disability or a neurodevelopmental abnormality. Probably every child has been damaged by the mercury in the vaccines. And we have certainly almost 4 times as much dementia and Alzheimer's disease as they have in communist China. Why? because, of course, we insist on giving our elderly this vaccine that contains mercury and aluminum, and we fluoridate the water and we destroy their minds. But it's great for Medicare and Social Security, because these people die off, and there is a population control agenda. And if you haven't heard my talk, planned population reduction, none dare call it genocide or population control. You need to get them. You need to get our 4-tape set on population control. You need to get my monograph. The population control agenda, it's available on our website for nothing. Or if you get into the other things, just ask for a free copy of the population control agenda. We'll send it to you. And then help us get the word out. And then please pray for America. Pray for revival, but pray for Radio Liberty, our provision and protection. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, that illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. And I need to remind you, the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views, and, well, for the next hour, they're going to be the views of Barry Shamus. So, without further ado, hi, Barry. How are you doing?
Hi, I'm here.
All right, fine. Well, you're here, and you're going to have to get started talking. So Barry's going to bring us up to date on what's going on in the Near East. Barry's a Jewish patriot who spent pretty close to 30 years writing about corruption over there in Israel, did the classic story about the murder of Rabin and the involvement of their state organizations, the conspiracy at the highest level of the Jewish government, of the Israeli government, to cover up the murder of the premier of Israel. That was Rabin. So, but you pick up the story. What's going on over in Israel today? And really, we had a conversation, I guess it was just yesterday, in the early evening, where Barry is talking about really the growing threat to Israel from the missiles that suddenly the Hezbollah has, and Syria has, and it would appear that, well, there is a war looming over there. It's only a matter of time. You pick up the story.
Well, sure, why not? The main issue is that the U.S. military and the Israel Defense Forces next month are engaging in a major training exercise. It's against missile attacks from Iran, Syria, Lebanon, and Gaza. Now this is apparently going to be a very big, training exercise. The U.S. is going to be deploying, missile interceptors on ships, and the troops are already arriving in, Haifa, which, by the way, it's not such a good, it's not great news for Israel. It's over the years, whenever American troops or whenever the American Navy lands en masse in Haifa, they give them leaves, and they show up at the pubs, and they get noisy and drunk. And this has been really played down in a huge way. But a mass of American soldiers is not always good for the image of the United States when they land on foreign shores.
Now, right now, basically, do we have any ideas in matter of a few hundred troops, a few thousand troops? I mean, they're bringing American troops and putting them into Israel for these exercises that will be held next month. Do we have any idea how many troops are going?
Several hundred are already roaming Haifa. That's the news from Israel.
Okay, go right ahead.
We're talking about an exercise that won't work anyways. We're talking, Iran, you can try and knock down missiles, but Iran probably won't even shoot them. Why should they when Hezbollah in southern Lebanon have 80,000 missiles, mostly from Iran, apparently, smuggled through Syria and, of course, by boat to Lebanon. But these missiles are long-range. They can hit any target in Israel, all the way to Beersheba.
Amen to that. And, of course, I'm sure that Syria has a lot of missiles as well. They're probably quite sophisticated missiles, and those could well be their biological and chemical warheads on them. So, anyway, of course, they're going to have this exercise, supposedly, to see how effective defense will be. And I don't think it's any good defense.
Not unless they start shooting rockets at Israel. How are they going to tell if they knocked down rockets?
Well, you're absolutely right. And so a lot of these exercises, they'll be played out on a computer. But, I mean, the question is, do they have any idea what's really going to happen? And how could you possibly defend the little tiny country of Israel against 80,000 incoming rockets?
That's just from Hezbollah. Gaza is more of a kind of a pain in the neck. Their missiles are very primitive. Their soldiers are very cowardly. We saw that last January. But Hezbollah are not cowardly. They're very good fighters. And we saw that in 2006 when no more than 2,000 fighters. Really, they won the war against the IDF. And they cleared up northern Israel with just 4,000 missiles. They cleared northern Israel out of, anyone who had a car took his family and slept on the beaches of Tel Aviv or whatever hotel they could find. And that was just with 2,000 missile operators. In a real war where Hezbollah has got chemical heads aimed at Tel Aviv, the only solutions for ground forces to go in and actually capture southern Lebanon, which is not all that complicated, but if the Arabs plan this war properly, there may not be a Tel Aviv within a day. 10,000 missiles landing on Tel Aviv with gas floating around the city will knock out, the intelligence operations of the IDF, which are located in the Kiryat, in Tel Aviv, on the border of Ramat Gan. Again, Syria can add lots of chemical and biological weapons. Gaza, as we've stated, is not a major worry, but certainly Syria and Lebanon using Iranian-smuggled short range, what is short range? Medium range, from southern Lebanon all the way to Beersheba, all of Israel will be, literally be rubble if in the first day of this war 10 or 20,000 missiles are released. The Israeli Air Force can maybe stop a few of them, but they're going to have a major problem stopping tens of thousands of them. And here's the United States coming to Israel, for this PR military show And what it means is that Israel will be asked to give major concessions to be protected from Iran. And the United States supposedly are going to work hand in hand to knock down the missiles. This is all, well, it's a delusion at best. It's just a play. At worst, they're just deceiving the Israeli people outright. But this is what is taking place, that American and Israeli troops are going to stand with their missile interceptors and protect Israel. And, well, I'm going to say it again. It is a play. It's not the real thing. It's not in the real world. The real world is taking southern Lebanon, defeating Hezbollah, and bombing Damascus. I mean, that's the way the war is going to be fought. If Israel has even, let's say Israel wins some victory. Talk about a Pyrrhic victory. The country is burning, gas is floating around, buildings are rubble, but Israel once again won the war. It's not a this is not a victory, even if on paper Israel wins the war.
Well, of course, you have to ask yourself why the United States is holding these military exercises. It sounds, of course, like they'll have the Arrow and a ballistic missile system deployed. But then apparently they're going to have, what, the American warships off the coast helping to shoot down these 80,000 missiles. How can you possibly shoot down 80,000 missiles? And that's just from Hezbollah. Then you got Syria and Lebanon and Iran. I mean, you would be talking really about literally hundreds of thousands of missiles raining down on this little country.
The figure is astounding. Syria has probably, again, the 80,000 figure came from the Israeli President Peres. Why he announced that, who knows. But it came from him. Syria probably has 40,000 missiles. So we're already up to 120,000. And again, remember, the area of Israel is smaller than New Jersey. Imagine New Jersey being hit with 100,000 missiles. That would certainly disrupt the gambling in Atlantic City.
But do you think, Barry, that it may be just as it is here in America? We're recently, this last week, been told, oh, my goodness, we're convinced there's another terrorist threat. You know, if you see anybody that's got an unusual-looking backpack, or you see an unusual, a package anyplace, report it immediately. And what they're doing is trying to scare the American people to death. Well, we know that they're not really scared of terrorism here in the United States. If they did, they would have closed the border 8 years ago. They've left the border open, so all those jihad terrorists, Islamic terrorists could come in here. They know it's all a fraud. We haven't had
You're
any...
You're not saying that Israel is a fraud.
No, I'm not saying that. I'm saying, but they're trying to scare the American people to death. Recently, do you think they're trying to scare the Israeli people to death? I think there's a real threat, but do you think they're going to focus in on that to try to get Israel just to make all sorts of concessions that will really effectively destroy any hope of the defense of Israel?
You know, you're underestimating the level of genuine Arab hatred against Israel. In America, it's a very big country, and frankly, the level of danger is so far removed from what Israel lives with daily that you can't compare the two. It makes no sense. Look, you have to look at what your president has been doing lately and why. Well, you know, he was the actual chairman of the UN Security Council today.
Isn't that incredible? You know, instead of worrying about America and all of our problems, it's almost like he wants to become sort of president of the world.
Well, he gave a very strange speech today. It was very poorly received, but the only time there was applause in that speech of his was when he announced that America will be stopping Israeli settlement expansion. Then he got some applause. Look, he's after, first of all, he's after nuclear disarmament, which, by the way, I'm not opposed to. I don't have any objections to all nuclear weapons disappearing from this planet. No objections at all. But he's aiming at Iran and North Korea. It's not as if Iranian nuclear inspectors are coming to the States and looking at American nuclear facilities. It's a very one-sided announcement of nuclear disarmament has very little to do with anyone examining the nuclear facilities in America or Russia. They're interested in Iran and North Korea. And they're trying to get the world really focused on, again, Iran, North Korea, but most importantly, and Israel. The deal here is that Israel disarm. Now, again, you can't be pro-nuclear, but if you're Israel and you're a cornered rat and there's nowhere left to go, and, well, you just kind of threaten everyone in sight with nuclear destruction, and hopefully your nation will survive. Now, for Israel, it makes a lot of sense to have that deterrent. And the Obama administration wants Israel to lose its deterrent along with Iran and North Korea. And that's why, again, this exercise coming up is somehow to show that Iranian missiles, which aren't, again, we'll talk about the Hezbollah and their ties to Iran shortly, but the fact of the matter is, it's like lobbing a grenade into Israel, the border between Lebanon and Israel. A rocket has to go, well, to get to Nahariya, it has to go 10 miles. What missile is going to stop a rocket from going 10 miles? To Haifa, it's all of 20 miles. It's, again, if Iran shoots a medium-range missile in Israel, some sort of interceptor can knock it down. There's a chance. There's some warning. You can't knock down a missile that's traveling 25 miles in, what, 30 seconds? Nothing is that fast or that good. Especially not the aero system, the Israeli aero system, which doesn't even work against medium-range missiles, let alone short-range missiles. But nonetheless, to get Israelis used to the American diplomacy, in comes the American Navy, supposedly to stop a threat from Iran, which, as I have said over and over on the show, that is not a real threat. And, well, President of Russia Medvedev announced this week that President of Israel Peres promised him that Israel won't attack Iran, which is no problem with that promise. Israel never intended to attack Iran. The problem is Hezbollah in Syria, and nothing can stop that we know about. Nothing can stop a missile from going 20 miles and causing immense damage to Israel. It's not 1,800 miles from Iran. So again, this exercise is against Iran. When the enemy isn't Iran, The enemy is at Israel's borders in the north, Syria and Lebanon.
I know, but of course their missiles in all probability came from Iran. And I think people have to understand these, I'm sure, are very, very sophisticated missiles. They're not the, these toys that they're lobbing in from Gaza. You know, you can't aim. I'm sure these other missiles will be very, very deadly. And of course, we are living, I believe, in very dangerous times for Israel. And certainly, if you look at what's going on over there, none of it is logical. So if it's not logical, there's got to be another explanation. But you go ahead.
Well, the other explanation is this CFR business, George Mitchell, who really is, he's just the U.S. representative to the Middle East, and supposedly Hillary Clinton is the boss, but Mitchell is running Netanyahu through circles. Before this latest summit, this week at the UN, Netanyahu met with Abbas, and you know this. I mean, this is not secret news. I mean, this has been on the mainstream television news. But before this meeting, Mitchell met three times with Netanyahu, twice in one day, to arrange this UN summit. Now, something happened that is, I wasn't there for this one, but Obama backed off on the settlement freeze a bit. At least the mainstream media is saying that Obama backed off, which, by the way, is the only logical thing to do. Israeli settlements are not settlements, they're cities. People hear the word settlement and they think tents and log cabins. These are cities. Male Adumim has almost 40,000 people. Ariel has almost 20,000 people.
Barry, you're going to have to hold that thought. We'll be back in just a moment here with Barry Shamish, talking about what's really going on. Barry, pick the story up.
Boy, that was very...
Gold and silver is tremendously undervalued. Global demand vastly exceeds mine supply by more than 60% annually. There is little in the financial world more certain than a coming explosion in the prices of gold and silver. The U.S. dollar continues to lose value and respect as the world's reserve currency. Our nation faces challenges on many fronts, and a day doesn't pass without another economist bringing forth warnings of impending economic calamity. There has never been a better time than right now to acquire physical gold and silver. Discount Gold and Silver Trading was founded on the principles of truth and honesty. We believe in providing a quality product, quality service, and most importantly, competitive pricing. We provide all forms of precious metals, including American gold, silver, platinum, and rare investment and circulated coins. Silver bars, rounds, and 90% silver bags are on hand for the silver investor. Gold self-directed IRAs are available. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. Toll free, that's 1-800-375-4188.
Most Americans are iodine deficient today because they stopped adding iodine to our milk and to our flour, and only about half of the salt that's consumed in the United States today contains iodine. So Radio Liberty has produced a 4-tape or a 4-CD set that discusses the health benefits of iodine. We also offer Iodorol. It contains 12.5 milligrams of iodine per tablet. And we also offer potassium iodide tablets that will protect your thyroid gland in case there's a nuclear attack. So if you'd like to order these products or obtain additional information, why don't you call 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. Or go to our website at RadioLiberty.com. That's RadioLiberty.com. Once again, our telephone number, 1-800-544-8927.
Did you know that there's an increasing amount of scientific data which says that fluoride in drinking water is dangerous? Are you aware that your drinking water may in fact contain many unhealthy substances, even things which can cause sickness or disease? If you'd like information on how to remove these contaminants, find out about the Berkey water filter. You can call 800-544-8927 for complete information. There is a way to return to having pure, safe drinking water. the Berkey water filter. Call 800-544-8927 for information about a product that could protect you and your family from waterborne disease. The number to call is 800-544-8927. Call today.
This is Pastor David Whitney with Institute on the Constitution. Our founders constructed this constitutional republic with the intent that citizens would function as the final check on the power of civil government. But that design would only work if the citizens understood our form of government as well as their responsibilities within that structure. That's why Institute on the Constitution has put together a host kit that enables anyone, anywhere, with any group of people to instruct them on our founding documents. We urge you to order a host kit. You can call us toll free at 866-730-9796. That's 866-730-9796. Or you can order it on the web. Go to our website, iotconline.com. The only way our republic will survive is if its citizens arm themselves with the knowledge of our founding fathers' original intent of the Constitution, the Declaration, and the Bill of Rights. Call us, 866-730-9796.
All sorts of concessions to Arafat, and Barry had a meeting, was giving a lecture to a number of Israeli military leaders, from colonel on up into the generals, and they told him in 2000 not to worry about Barak, you know, betraying Israel and giving away Temple Mount and certainly large segments of Jerusalem, that there was going to be a military action. It was going to be in a few weeks, and it was going to be basically a coup, and they were going to seize control of the Israeli government because they knew Barak did not represent the Israeli people. Well, Barry was told to remain quiet. It was going to happen in a few weeks, but it didn't happen in a few weeks. So then what happened, Barry?
Well, the outline of the coup was, it was very effective and very simple. You take a squadron of tanks into Jerusalem. You surround the Knesset. You give them half an hour to get out, or they're not, the army is not to be held responsible. You take one tank to the TV station and one to the radio station with a few squads of soldiers, take over the media, announce the coup, ask people to come in and to the Knesset and support the coup. In Jerusalem, they expected 250,000 people within a few hours to arrive to the Knesset to prevent any action from the IDF overturning the coup, and this was their plan. A good plan, actually. And I was delighted, but it didn't happen. After 4 months, I wrote about my lectures without naming names, and I said there was a coup planned against Barak. And lo and behold, 6 months later, Reuters announced the coup headed by Major General Mazouz, who became the Israeli Attorney General. I didn't know that. I just knew the lower officers. But word for word, they described precisely what I had written, how the coup was supposed to take place, and how it was overturned. And I got the story right. But here is Barak. Now, we've gone over this man, Barak, before. I mean, this man has got a record of murder. He's got a record of thievery. Well, he's up there with Paris. Not as good. Nobody is as murderous and as lecherous and as thieverous. I don't even know if that's the word, actually.
Now, Barry,
doesn't matter, it's Paris.
Barry, don't sugarcoat it. Just come out and say that he is just a scumbum, but go ahead.
Yes. That's essentially what I mean. As Barak, and Barak is now the defense minister of Israel, and look, I'm going to add this. To understand Israel, you have to separate the Israeli people from their government. They're not the same entities. In fact, they've got very little in common. The Israeli people are suffering miserably from their government. The likes of Barak and Peres, well, they're nobody's neighbors. These are people involved in a high level of felonious behavior. And, well, the Israeli government is not just Netanyahu. The Israeli government, the military side of it, is labor Zionists in the form of Ehud Barak.
Well, I think you have the same problem that in Israel that we have in America. You have the apparent government, then you have an invisible government that ties into these labor Zionists. As you refer them sometimes as Sabbateans, but they are people with an entirely different agenda. And we have essentially the same situation here in the United States. We have a visible government, we have an invisible government, and I love my government. The invisible government that's taken over is inherently evil, and I really believe they're influencing the government of Israel. I believe that many of your leaders in Israel are simply puppets of the invisible government that runs America. They'd like to convince us the Israelis are running the United States, but they're doing an incredible poor job if they are. No, I think it's just the opposite. But the last thing they want is for the people of Israel and America and the world to understand there is an invisible cabal, and behind that are powerful, I believe, powerful spiritual forces. We're going to be back here in just a moment with Barry Shamish talking about what's going on in Israel today. One time, of course, Kate Smith was on television every Saturday evening, and she sang that. That was her theme song. And, of course, the television programs in those days were wholesome, and we had moral standards, and not only on television, but certainly in our motion pictures. And we weren't, of course, entering into a downward spiral of depravity such as grips our nation today. I don't know if God will ever bless America again. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest, of course, is Barry Shamish. And Barry, before we go on, I want you to go ahead and get your telephone number out, your web page. Tell people how they can get your books, how they can get your DVDs, and, of course, how they can invite you to come and speak to them. And I understand you have a number of invitations for speaking engagements. Is that right?
Tomorrow night I'm going to be in Cooper City, Florida, near Miami. If anyone's listening, I'm going to give you an address to show up at 8 p.m. I'm going to be at 5700 Southwest 106th Avenue in Cooper City. I'll repeat that while you get your pens, I guess. 5700 Southwest 106th Avenue, Cooper City, Florida. I'll be there tomorrow at 8 o'clock. To get my books, you go to Lulu, www.lulu.com. You'll see a search box. You double-click books and then write in my name, C-H-A-M-I-S-H, that's Shamish. My website is BarryShamish.com. And if you want to invite me to lecture, my phone number is 904-315-8079. That's 904-315-8079. In October, I'm going to be in Omak, Washington, Sumas, Washington, and in Portland, Oregon. Go to the website, you'll get my email address, and if you live in those cities, I'll tell you who to contact. Now, let's get back to the issue of what Israel can do. One of the reasons why Israel could never attack Iran, which I have been saying over and over again, is that the Americans have got a lot of planes in Iraq. Now, the Polish godfather, that's Zbigniew Brzezinski, Polish-born, he was the American National Security Advisor for reasons no one knows.
I would say that no one knows that he was National Security Advisor because he was there under the Carter administration. He was under the Carter administration because he and David Rockefeller got Jimmy Carter elected. He was an obscure governor of the state of Georgia. Nobody had ever heard of him. And, of course, the Trilateral Commission, which Zbigniew Brzezinski organized for David Rockefeller, mobilized the media outlets, and suddenly Jimmy Carter's on the front page of Time Magazine and Newsweek Magazine and U.S. News and World Report, and he's interviewed on CBS, NBC, ABC, all of their what I call Brotherhood of Darkness outlets, and they basically created Jimmy Carter and the payment back for, simply becoming the President of the United States. Jimmy Carter allowed the members of the Trilateral Commission, this little clique of very wealthy people who I believe are tied into the occult, to take over control of his administration. Something like 20 or 28 of them were in his administration. There was only about 80 of them and that many in his administration. And, of course, Zbigniew Brzezinski became the National Security Advisor. He was simply, I don't think that Jimmy Carter selected him. I think Jimmy Carter did exactly what he was told to do then, exactly as he's doing today. But go right ahead.
Well, Carter was, of course, Counsel of Foreign Relations, as was Mondale, as was Vance. Without going into the past, Brzezinski still has some sort of influence. Well, again, as I said, he's the Polish godfather. And, of course, the Polish godfather, as we well know, makes you an offer you can't understand. For those who understood that, we'll find what Brzezinski did this week is make a very modest proposal that if Israel actually gets its air force in the air to travel to Iran, that we'll just simply shoot them down from our bases, no less, in Iraq, which I've been saying again for a year, that unless the Israeli Air Force wants a dogfight with the American Air Force, they're not taking off to Iran. And he used a very strange analogy. He says, we will cause a liberty, that is SS liberty in reverse. Which is, it's not a reverse at all. The SS Liberty was sunk by the Israelis in 67 under the orders from the United States, and specifically Lyndon Johnson, who wanted to bring down the Marxist government of Egypt with another phony Gulf of Tonkin attack on an American ship, which the Israelis were going to set up, but it wasn't their idea. Nonetheless, this is Brzezinski's just saying what I have been saying on this show, is that Israel cannot have a dogfight and start being knocked down or knocking down American planes to get to Iran. But again, Iran is the issue. Hezbollah is the issue. But a very strange item has been broadcast this week from an Israeli general. We don't know his name, but he says Iran has taken over the Hezbollah, that the Iranian Revolutionary Guards have essentially taken over southern Lebanon because Hezbollah really don't want another round with Israel, in that they defeated Israel in 2006 and forced all of northern Israel to run for the center of the country. They also suffered some pretty serious blows from the Israeli Air Force, and they don't want another battle as much as Iran wants another battle. So slowly but surely, according to this intelligence report, the Revolutionary Guards of Iran have taken over the missile sites all through southern Lebanon. And in essence, Israel will be fighting Iran in the next war, and less so Hezbollah. And that, again, is from, well, I read that in Haaretz, and it's been spread elsewhere. It's from a high-ranking IDF general who doesn't want to be named. But I can believe it, and I have no problem with the source. You know, I had a phone call yesterday morning with someone who's coming to my lecture in Cooper City, and he was talking in the old way that with all these missiles, Israel has got to let the Arabs know that if it faces a missile attack, it will knock out the Arab oil fields. And I had to explain to the man something very basic. Arabs are not a homogeneous enemy. They've got their own divisions. The oil fields are in Kuwait, they're in the United Arab Republics, and Saudi Arabia. They're in Sunni states. The Sunni states are not going to be involved in the next war. In the next war, it's going to be the Shiites of Iran and Hezbollah and the Alawites of Syria, not the Sunnis. I said to him, this business of knocking out Sunni oil fields makes no sense. You're attacking non-combatants with no control over Iran. In fact, the Sunnis are more afraid of the Iranians than they are of the Israelis. And more to the point, the Sunni states of Jordan and Egypt have peace treaties with Israel. As phony as they are, they're not going to be attacking Israel in the next war. And he started giving me this stuff about the Samson option, and Israel could nuke the Arab world. I said, the only place Israel will have enemies are places like Lebanon and Syria. And if you nuke Lebanon or nuke Damascus, you're going to have, you're just nuking yourself. Now, it may not be the same physical damage as being in the epicenter, but, you know, for 50 miles, you're going to have a radioactive cloud that's going to kill everyone in northern Israel, and you can't use that option. It makes no sense to use the option. But there's this thinking. You have to understand Israeli Jews, especially from the right, are thoroughly deluded. I'm saying this with a lot of experience. The Israeli right, the ones trying to defend Israel, just don't have a grip on reality. And this is another major problem. You don't have options. You don't, against the Sunni Arabs in the upcoming war. And the ones you do have options against are too close to use the Samson option against them. It's so simple to me. It really is so simple. But it's a hard thing to tell the Israeli right. They're just so thoroughly deluded.
All right, fine. Well, what you're talking about is what is logical. It would be totally illogical for Israel to attack Iran. But does that mean it won't happen? Well, we're just going to have to wait and see. I hope and pray that you're right, Whitberg. I believe that we're in for some very, very difficult times.
I get this from the Christians, too. They found one line in the Bible that Damascus will be in ruins, therefore Israel will nuke Damascus. If Israel nukes Damascus, it's also nuking the Galilee. Damascus is 10 miles from the Golan Heights and all of 30 miles from Tiberias. You nuke Damascus, you nuke the Galilee.
You're absolutely right.
Right.
You can stand on the top of the mountains there, and you look down the Golan Heights, and you can look down and actually see, you know, Syria. You turn around and you look down, and you're overlooking the Sea of Galilee. It's 20 miles. You think it might be 30 or 40 miles? You think is it actually just 20 miles?
Well, the Golan Heights is probably 15 miles from one end to the other. It's, again, a nuclear cloud travels more than 15 miles. A nuclear cloud will get to Tiberias. It'll knock out. You can't nuke Damascus without nuking northern Israel. Again, the epicenter will be Damascus. That'll be rubble. But the radiation is a heck of a worry, and it kills just the same way, but buildings stay up.
All right, fine. Well, you go ahead, because, as I say, I hope you're right, and I hope the Christian belief is wrong, but only time's going to tell.
Well, again, you have to deal with modern history, and people tend to take words or sentences from the Bible and apply them to modern history when they don't work. But neither here nor there, there are enough that seem to work that I guess it can be done that way. I'm looking at the news, the modern news, and let's go over to another issue. Now, Israel this week warned India of an impending attack like the Mumbai attack of earlier this year. Apparently, India took this warning at face value and seriously. Now, Pakistan placed under arrest the supposed leader of the attack under house arrest. I don't know why he's not in prison if for the 139 dead, including 8 Jews, at the Chabad house. But Hafiz Saeed was placed under house arrest. Well, India sent the Israeli message to Pakistan, and they think they have stopped another attack on Mumbai. Let me tell you a little about the Israelis and Jews in the Chabad house went through with this attack, and it's not been publicized anywhere. And when I got the...
This is the attack on Mumbai, isn't it? You're talking about Mumbai.
India.
Right.
It used to be called Bombay.
Okay.
Which is a much better name for the city.
Okay.
I don't know why they changed it. But nonetheless, it was, I believe, it was January of this year. Earlier this year, there was an attack on Mumbai from Pakistan that left 139 dead and many hundreds wounded. A squad of terrorists went into the Chabad house. Now, I found out what was done to the rabbi and his wife. In short, she was pregnant. The terrorists, while she was alive, ripped open her stomach, pulled the baby out, and stomped it with her shoes on the floor while she was alive. And I would assume, I hope shock took over and she didn't see her baby stomped to death. But I understand that's not guaranteed. The husband, beside the wife, had his genitals cut off while he was alive. This butchery took place in the Chabad house. Now, Rosh Hashanah has just passed, and I did not go to the Chabad service in my town simply because last Passover I told him, I said...
You told the rabbi in charge, right?
The rabbi. I said, you've got to put some security around your little synagogue. Even if it's only a locked door and a peephole, I said, you can't take the risk. So I got to his house on Passover, and the door is wide open, and there's a sign on the lawn that says, this house is protected by Hashem, by God. And that doesn't do it for me.
Hold that thought. Our guest has been Barry Shamish. We'll be back in just a moment to wrap up tonight's program.
Heart disease is on the rise. Clogged arteries, high blood pressure, and high cholesterol levels may not be fully detected by you, but the symptoms are there. Loss of energy, blood sugar spikes and drops, poor circulation, and irregular heartbeat are just a few of these that can alert you that something is wrong. Hear how Heart and Body Extract is making a difference in thousands of people's lives across America.
My blood pressure has normalized. My diabetes has totally improved.
Everyone is telling me now how much healthier I look, and I'm telling everyone how much healthier I feel. I recommend Heart and Body Extract to everyone.
Anybody over 40 in the North American continent should be using this product as a preventative to keep their cardiovascular system healthy.
Order your 2-month supply today by calling 866-295-5305. That's 866-295-5305. Or order online, hbextract.com. Heart and Body Extract, 866-295-5305 or hbextract.com.
We know America is changing, but most of the changes that are taking place seem to be designed to take away our freedom. And what can you do to remedy the current situation? Well, you can become informed, and one of the best ways to become informed is to subscribe to Republic Magazine, because that magazine provides the information that's suppressed in most other news magazines. If you want to oppose the effort to establish a one-world government, if you want to preserve freedom here in the United States and throughout the world, I suggest you subscribe to Republic Magazine, and you can do that by calling 1-800-873-1620. That's 800-873-1620 or access their website at www.republicmagazine.com. That's republicmagazine.com. I suggest you get extra copies for your family and your friends.
This is Pastor David Whitney with Institute on the Constitution. Our founders constructed this constitutional republic with the intent that citizens would function as the final check on the power of civil government. But that design would only work if the citizens understood our form of government as well as their responsibilities within that structure. That's why Institute on the Constitution has put together a host kit that enables anyone, anywhere, with any group of people to instruct them on our founding documents. We urge you to order a host kit. You can call us toll free at 866-730-9796. That's 866-730-9796. Or you can order it on the web. Go to our website, iotconline.com. The only way our republic will survive is if its citizens arm themselves with the knowledge of our founding fathers' original intent of the Constitution, the Declaration, and the Bill of Rights. Call us, 866-730-9796.
His point of view. It's always fascinating to listen to what he has to say. There's a great deal of wisdom there. I'm coming from a Christian evangelical point of view, and because I believe you can't understand anything that's going on in Israel without understanding that Israel exists because God allows it to exist at this time in history. And if you study the Yom Kippur War, if you study the 67 War, it's obvious that God intervened. He intervened in the 1948 war. So many things, you can actually see God's hand there. And certainly a great source of information is Billy Crone's, Pastor Billy Crone's, 10 DV series. It's called The Final Countdown. It comes in five DVD sets, part one, part two. We recommend it, first of all, because the scriptures are there to explain to you. Not only was Israel founded as a nation, but it was founded as a nation in one day. It was prophesied, and the shekel was to become the form of currency, which was entirely new. Certainly, Hebrew was to once again become the official language, and that hadn't been true for 2,000 years. God has created Israel for a purpose. He's protected it, and I think he's going to continue to protect it. This doesn't mean that the Israelis are not going to have terrible suffering or that the majority of them may not die in the coming time. But God has a purpose for Israel, just as he has a purpose for every one of you out there in the listening audience. We believe Final Countdown, the 10 DVD series, part 1, part 2, are very important. You get them by calling 1-800-544-8927. Pastor Billy's written a book, and of course it's nice to have the book because it has all the scripture references there, so that you can begin to read and study, and then you can speak intelligently to others about what's going on. Now, of course, Pastor Billy's doing another 10-part series with us on creation. Excellent material, and we do have those 10 DVDs as well, and of course several other DVD sets, one on RFID. There's 4 DVDs there. One called Get a Life. It's the story of Billy's conversion from being involved in the occult to becoming a turned-on Christian. But you cannot understand anything going on in Israel or in the United States today unless you look at it through the lens of prophecy, and I really believe that. I mean, at no time in history has it been possible to create a casteless society prior to now. Certainly, at no time in history had the Jews returned to the Holy Land, and that was absolutely essential for the prophecies to come to pass. So I believe we're living in prophetic times. I don't have a timetable, but so much that's going on today brings me to the conclusion that there is going to be a war with Iran. It is totally illogical, as Barry says. I mean, it would not make any sense at all. And yet, of course, everything points in that direction. So much of what's going on, for instance, the recent release of the Libyan responsible, we're told, for the downing of the Pan Am 103 over Lockerbie, Scotland. The only trouble is that all the evidence, and if you go up on the Internet, you read it wasn't the Libyan at all. Who did it? The Scots released the Libyan because they knew he wasn't guilty. It was an Iranian operation that was covered up by our government, just as the Iranian involvement in the attack on the American embassy in Beirut in 83 and on the American Marine barracks in 83. They were all Iranian operations, and we've been consistently covering for the Iranians because the American government brought the Ayatollahs to power back in 1979 under the leadership of a man named Zinu Brzezinski. We live in a world, and unless you understand prophecy, and unless you understand the satanic movement, the Brotherhood of Darkness, nothing makes sense. Our number, 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-544-8927. Please pray for Radio Liberty.
You're tuned to the Global Star Radio Network. Thanks for listening.
Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to the Wednesday edition of the Power Hour. It is Wednesday, the 23rd of September, 2009. We thank you for joining us today. We thank you for thinking outside the proverbial cage, because it is nothing but a cage, ladies and gentlemen. It's going to be a cage in the near future. Well, if you're listening to television, it is just absolutely, well, for instance, let me give you an example. Do you think Sarah Palin will run in 2012? The latest on whether or not Sarah Palin will run in 2012. The question is, who cares? It is 2009. The whole world could end by that time. There's so many things that could change. Why are they focusing on Sarah Palin? Could it be diversion? Could it be we don't have any other real news to tell you, to pacify you, because we don't want you to know what's really going on? What could it be? Well, New York City is on high alert again. High alert because of the guy with the backpacks that might have not been caught in time. So now, anywhere where there might be entertainment, sports, things of low morals, the Al-Qaeda may attempt to attack that. So they're now warning all the football games, all the entertainment areas, it could happen to you. That's right, ladies and gentlemen. The scare is on again. One of these days, it's not going to be a scare. It's going to be the real deal. Well, that's one thing in the news. The other thing in the news yesterday, if you didn't notice it, or over the weekend, the president was all over the television. It was all Obama all the time. Every news network except for Fox. And, of course, Fox made it known how hurt they were that the president would not come to their station. All it is just playing one against the other. The news networks have turned into a I got my feelings hurt scenario. It's really ridiculous how low they have stooped now to what is called news. Well, the president was all over television, including the Letterman show. Now, you know, when the country is in the toilet, things are not going well. We've got a number of wars. We're not quite sure right now. Somewhere between 4 to 6 wars going on. But then who really knows where the wars are? And he's on Letterman, entertaining everybody and being funny and cute.
Is that to make everybody feel like things are okay? Or is it because he has so much time he doesn't know what else to do with his time? Well, it's getting to be insulting to the people of this country. At the same time, yesterday, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, you know, that's one of the cartoon characters, there's three of them, that were supposed to attend trial in Guantanamo. Did you know that he didn't show up? He didn't know that was the day he was supposed to be there, and he was supposed to respond to some things. You know, this is getting to be such a weak story. The first time, he was supposed to go to court, too, and he didn't realize it was the right day either. You know what? They can coerce people to do things. They could have said, hey, buddy, you're going to court today. But, oh, no, they said he asked for a movie instead. Do you realize how the ring in your nose is being used with this huge, long chain to drag you around to believe that all of this stuff is real? Does anybody think that Khalid Sheikh Mohammed would actually say, you mean I was supposed to go to court today? Oh, my gosh. He is what's called a prisoner. In other news, Big Pharma microchip is going to force drug people. Just when we thought that won't happen. We've got some Power Hour chatter. I do not like to hear from Jim Motyka, and Jim Motyka is usually on target. And nurses now are rallying against the mandatory swine flu vaccine. Did you hear about the 60,000 people in Times Square? I'll tell you why you didn't hear. And a big pandemic outbreak exercise in Panama. Back in 3 minutes.
Have you ever heard of a clay facial or a clay bath or a clay body wrap? Why do people use clay? Because it works. Living Clay is an all-natural bentonite clay and is recognized for its effectiveness in drawing out impurities and toxins. Living Clay has a